So if you just introduce yourself.
Yes. Yep,
and
no problem.
Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, kia ora koutou. Call Luke Faithful Aho. My name is Luke Faithful. I am a partner at Mitchell Dash. We are the environmental consultants that have been engaged by TTR to inform them in all capacities in the planning framework and the consent development of the consent applications. Myself with Dr. Phil Mitchell, we were the co-authors of the original impact assessment in 2016, and I also assisted Dr. Mitchell in the drafting of the conditions and his evidence documents as part of that process. So we've had a long-standing relationship with TTR as a project, and we've been carried through to the different framework in which we're looking at the application under now. So I'm proposing to cover off the consent sought, also the effects, just to provide a brief overview building on what Dr. McDiarmid has presented, and I'll provide a bit more of a focus on the condition set itself. So as set out in section 4 of the impact assessment, the proposal is actually seeking all the necessary marine consent under the EEZ Act. Now, the activities include disturbance, extraction, deposition, alteration of the seabed. And then the next bullet point actually talks to, there's one word missing there, and it's meant to say associated with the discharges of sediments and substances associated with the extractions. We're seeking a term of 35 years as a discretionary activity under the EEZ Act. As Mr. Eggers and others have described today, the actual mining activities is shorter than that 35 years. That 35 years provides for pre-commencement environmental monitoring, the post-benthic recovery monitoring, the construction of the different components required to undertake the extraction activities, and so forth. There are no additional consents sought through this process. However, there might be some minor RMA-based consents or others once the more detailed sort of decisions around portage and those types of things have actually been confirmed. There is no direct project consents for discharge or disturbance under the RMA or any others. In terms of the project effects, there's a general summary of the effects that are related to the substantive application. Alan has highlighted the environmental effects. Sedimentation, coastal processes, marine ecology have all been covered by Dr. McDiarmid. Visual, seascape and natural character effects are addressed in section 5.11 of the impact assessment. Cultural effects have been talked to briefly in respect to tikanga and treaty settlement by Mr. Majuri, and we've also got a summation of the effects and mitigation in section 5.13.1 of the impact assessment. There's also existing interests in other matters, air quality, health effects, environmental monitoring, other disturbance and things which are covered under section 5.13. As per the previous comments from Mr. Slyfield, these effects assessments have been updated subsequent to the 2016 application, and those have been updated are directed in the TTR memo dated 4th of August under direction responses to direction B.
Would you say that while you're there, we actually had a question. The list of the application documents,
yes.
The title of the documents is very different to the way the documents are referred to, for example, in the memorandum or also in the impact assessment. We're wondering whether it would be possible for you to produce a list, basically reproduce the list of application documents that's also on the website, but with the names of each document, the way they are referred to in your documents, just to make it easier for us to find.
Yes, sure, no problem at all. Yeah.
And then specifically to the to your report, the McDiarmid et al. 2024, I could not find the PDF as part of the application. It might be because of the naming, but if you could maybe check whether that PDF is actually provided as part of the application.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
So in terms of the management of effects, so there's set out essentially in section 6 of the impact assessment. However, the primary mechanism for addressing the effects is the comprehensive monitoring and management framework that's established through the pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan and the environmental management and monitoring plan. That framework's provided for through the consent conditions, and it's a multi-staged approach. that will ensure the project effects are effectively and efficiently monitored and managed. I guess I'll just pause there for a minute and sort of explain the basis of the structure of the conditions and kind of where they've landed through at the moment. So the starting point for the conditions, as we spoke to earlier, is the 2017 decision from the EPA. So that was a process through which the EPA, DOC, technical reviewers, planners on behalf of the EPA and other parties had been involved in joint witness state conferencing, review of those documents and input into the controls and the management measures that are set out in those conditions. We use those basically as the base set because they were familiar to the process, familiar to stakeholders in EWI groups and other parties who had engaged on the process. So what we were conscious that while the order of those conditions might not necessarily reflect a logical order of process, they were familiar, so we were conscious about changing things too much to attract sort of a criticism that might come from, well, you've actually significantly changed what has already been considered and assessed through the process. We did revisit the language around some of the conditions, particularly the management plans, incorporated purposes and better objectives in some of the management plans to sort of better reflect what's accepted for conditions best practice. That's sort of moved somewhat in the 10 years, nearly. We've been conscious of the change of that structure and have tried to avoid confusion of sort of broader parties that who would be looking at those conditions again. The approach provided for within the condition has some quite clear sort of controls and provisions in place. I'll go through them in a bit more detail, but the collective approach, in our opinion, it addresses the mechanism through which the effects can be appropriately managed throughout the course of the mining activities. In terms of effects conclusions, regarding environmental effects, we think that the effects are driven by the best available information. They'll be further validated through the pre-commencement environmental monitoring programs and also sort of monitored and managed through the process by the EMMP. In terms of the cultural effects, now it's well acknowledged that there is a fundamental opposition in a cultural sense to the proposal. However, we think that in respect to the physical elements of cultural impacts, we think there are crossovers with the Western science aspects of marine ecology and those types of elements, impacts on fisheries and those types of things. In the opinion of TTR, based on the advice from our advisors, those impacts, mitigation measures and management tools are well understood. So they're the actual effect process for controlling an eventual outcome in terms of a conclusion of effects is well provided for through the set of conditions, the design, the operational controls and the likes. Where there is probably a difference is the metaphysical aspects of cultural effects. Now those are less well understood from an applicant perspective, but in a general broad context, we understand that Te Ao Māori will view kaitiaki effects of Māori, those types of things, are kind of encompass some of those metaphysical elements. What we've tried to do through the effects framework is provide a mechanism through which the relationship is recognised, a tool and a mechanism through which iwi and their representation can be involved in the process going forward. And we think that's done through the Kaitiaki Reference Group involvements in the TRG and some of those other elements, which I can talk to a little bit in further detail. Now, the intention of those other conditions which aren't related to the physical elements are to provide an opportunity that for cultural values to be recognised and ensure that they're visible through the process and enable a mechanism through which they can continue to have a representation. So basically, overall, the effects will be localised, they're not significant beyond the active area, and based on the technical evidence, the environment of the South Taranaki Bight will not be materially harmed. So in terms of the consent conditions, so as we say, as I was saying before, sorry, the conditions have been developed over a sort of a cumulative process of processes. There's been input from other parties, there's been input from Department of Conservation, there's been input from an agreement from joint witnesses through previous processes, and that's essentially where we've got to with the base set of conditions. Now, from basically a framework, it provides for operational and activity controls, environmental monitoring plans, technical and cultural oversight, community stakeholder relationships, reporting review requirements. Really, in terms of how they all work together, there's a set of conditions provided as a pre-commencement startup sort of package, which captures sort of the first sort of 3 years of the program. They cover things like establishment of the technical reference group, the Kaitiaki reference group, extending offers to iwi to be involved in the process, pre-commencement, environmental monitoring, development of the operational sediment plume monitoring, development of final management plans, certification of those and those types of things. There's also a suite of vessel safety controls and those types of mechanisms which need to be confirmed through the design process, and also the development of an operational assessment report, which is essentially the 12-month forward-looking summary of the mine plan and the process around it. There's also the, following that, there is the commencement sort of operations, things around the operational controls, discharge limits, environmental limits, the community, the continuation of the monitoring once the activity starts, the application of the operational controls around your discharges, your depth cuts, buffers around discharges from the CMA boundary and those types of things. There's the monitor, forecast and response loop, which looks at the reporting and the recording through the EMP, the operational sediment plume, the validation process and those types of things. The Kaimana monitoring, the Kaitiaki reference group, the TRG role through that continuous monitor, forecast, respond process. There's also the, then followed by the report and notify process, which captures your quarterly operations report, your annual reporting, as well as sort of notifying operations with fisheries and Kupe and the likes there. And then that's sort of finalised through the post-extraction recovery monitoring and surveying program. So I'll talk to those in a little bit more detail as we go through. So the approach from here is essentially looking at the conditions in a bit more of an individual sort of basis. If that's useful, let me know. If it's getting a bit sort of too specific for this process, just let me know and I can speed things up a little bit.
Well, so I wonder, those of the panel who have technical expertise, which I don't have, may be interested in some of these things. But
yes.
if you have really just summarised the conditions,
yeah,
you may not need just to repeat what we can see on the,
yeah, correct,
on the slides.
Yep, I have some.
I'll leave it up to you to make any comments, but I don't think you need to take us through all the detail.
Yep, no problem. I do have some particular notes, maybe sort of broadening some explanation around how the pre-commencement monitoring ties in with some of the operational sediment plume and tying in some of those other elements. But yeah, that's noted. Thank you, sir. Okay, so in terms of the front end of the conditions, we've got those hard limits which have been identified through development of the technical assessments and the technical reporting and operational requirements that support the application. So it's those conditions 3, condition 4, condition 5, 6, 7 and 8. So those conditions in themselves, they provide the hard limits through which the application operations are restricted to. Those limits essentially control the effects and where the effects conclusions get to. So they are the driver for the basis of those conditions. Alison has spoken to the slides around the fines and the sediments and those limits. The extractions and tonnage have also been talked through by Alan in his earlier slides. When we talk about the sediment limits in terms of 5 and 6, As I alluded to earlier, Schedule 2 and 3 talk to the sediment, suspended sediment limits that had been identified through the 2017 process, and Schedule 2 has the table which identifies where those gaps are. Schedule 3 talks about the process where the pre-commencement environmental monitoring program takes the background limits that are there, provides the input into the operational sediment plume model, and then establishes what those 25th, 50th and those missing percentile limits are. The benthic ecology, I'll just say in terms of condition number 7, the percentage reduction is going to be measured off the pre-commencement environmental monitoring data set. So that pre-commencement environmental monitoring is a really key piece, because not only for the building on that existing baseline data set and providing the guidance for the EMP, but it also sets the benchmark against which the recovery is set and measured against later on once the mining activities have been completed. In terms of the seabirds and mammals, again, these are environmental limits. These are intended as hard limit indicators, and for the no adverse effects condition under 9 and number 10, those are, you know, provide consistency with the NZCPS policy 11 basis for no adverse effects on those particular species. And then the other species, minimise effects, etc., capture the 11 policy 11B. You may note, depending on the extent to which you've read the previous evidence for the Hawera hearing, there was a change in wording of the conditions from no adverse effects at a population level to just no adverse effects. Now, the at a population level term came through the process of the 2017 hearing, and that was agreed through joint witness conferencing as an indicator to better provide for a connection between the NZCPS policy 11 elements. The practicalities of at a population level and what that meant in terms of provision and monitoring plans and those types of things was challenged and further explored through the subsequent hearing processes. And there was agreement, and the justification is set out in the evidence and the rebuttal evidence from Dr. Thompson, Dr. Childerhouse, and Dr. Mitchell on behalf of TTR through the Hawera hearing as to why the extraction of that population level from the condition itself was appropriate, and the intent of the condition and the structure still provided the same overall protection for those species.
And look, does the NZCPS apply out here?
It's been questioned to the extent to which it was applied. It was stated that it did apply in a broad sense under, I can't remember exactly which section, 59 other matters. Morgan, do you remember?
Marine management regime.
Yeah, other marine management.
I can talk about that.
So it's a broad sort of application under one of the Section 59 matters of the EEZ Act. So we have spoken to the noise limits. Alison touched on these. I just wanted to add that the noise limits and the marine mammal controls set out in the condition documents were developed very closely with DOC in the 2016 process. As Alan alluded, DOC has supported the application in that form as well as we understand in its current form. They played a very key role in terms of identifying what those actual controls and level of appropriateness was for marine mammals, particularly in that area. We talked through, there's a number of vessel and operational controls that are identified here. I'll just briefly say, you know, the controller operation and anchor and vessel management, those types of things, are focused on addressing suspended sediment concentrations, discharge elements, soft start procedures, look to marine mammal management focus. The anchoring and those other elements talk about controlling interactions with other vessels and those types of things. There's also transshipment controls, which are set out in condition 26 and then further provided for in the collision management plan, which addresses when the floating storage vessel comes and extracts materials from the IMV and some of those interacting activities between TTR vessels and other vessels as well.
So I'm sorry, return pipe discharge greater or equal than 4 metres above the seabed, should that be the other way around?
Yes, sorry, that might just be a...
Yeah, I haven't checked the condition, but it should be 4 metres or closer to the seabed.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, that I think that was must be one of my...
No, that's fine.
Yeah, thank you for picking that up. What have we got next? Again, so further operational controls based around sort of safety and environmental management, spill controls, which focus on unplanned spill events, and also the approach that will be taken in the instance that happens. Again, just to clarify, that's not an activity for which consent is sought through this process, but given the nature of the activities, the requirements around providing for those instances where that does occur. That's part of the broader considerations of the application process in itself. And probably just to tie in with that, condition 107 talks about the risk management and the requirement for the personal indemnity insurance of $500 million. And that's probably an event linked to an unplanned spill event, either or a collision event, which results in a large-scale fuel or oil discharge as a result of such an accidental activity, that would be probably one of the key drivers for initiating that trigger of that risk consent. Now, this I won't sort of go into too much detail around the pre-commencement and the environmental monitoring plans. Alison has provided a very good summary. I'll just sort of state that the draft pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan was actually provided as the baseline environmental monitoring plan in the package of appendices provided with the application. So that was based on the document that was submitted with the 2016 application. Now, the reason that it wasn't updated as part of this process is because there is a requirement for that to be submitted in a final form following any granting of resource consent through a process to have it confirmed and then certified by the EPA. So there was an acknowledgement that the requirements and the content of that report would change as a result of any hearing process or any application process. So we were cognizant that to go ahead and do a wholesale change on that application and potentially be looking at the requirement to do another wholesale change prior to a certification or lodging it to certification by the EPA and also having it reviewed by the TRG and other parties would sort of be jumping the gun a little bit. So that's just a little bit of background as to why that is the background environmental monitoring plan, excuse me, and not the pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan as stated in the conditions. The intention of the pre-commencement environmental monitoring is to provide additional data to validate and verify that current data set. So there has been a significant amount of work and investigations into what's happening out there, and the pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan will build onto that. It will inform the operational sediment plume model, and then that will subsequently inform those missing limits, the missing numerical figure to sit under those TSS limits that have been established as your environmental effects indicators for the management of the operations. As I said, that process for in the PCMP sets out how the SSCs will be identified. That's set out in section 6.4.6 of the impact assessment and also schedule 3 of the conditions themselves. So this slide just looks at how they sort of work together and just talks through what Alison and I have already sort of spoken to. In terms of condition 51, that requires a review of Schedule 3, which which sets, those suspended sediment limits. And the OPSM is that key driver of where those, is it just, I am repeating it, and I know, but the identification of the numerical value to go against those limits. So the limits themselves are the percentiles. Percentiles are the drivers for the effects that are experienced in the environment, and the process set out within the conditions simply provides a numerical value to those. So that will be constantly reviewed throughout the whole operation. The OPSM is validated and confirmed by live monitoring data, by the operational assessment report, and that those are constantly being fed into the OPSM. So those values over the course of the mining program, they may go, the numerical value may change throughout the time, but the percentiles, which are the directive for the effects, will not change because those have been established as what needs to happen at each time.
How will you ensure that there's no creep in baseline? Because the new data might be affected by the plume.
Yeah, so one of the roles of the operational sediment plume model was to distinguish between the background and the mining operation. So it's going to provide a data set which will have a clear indication of, you know, what your base data field is, what you're getting from the actual operation. So you shouldn't receive an ever-increasing percentile limit because you're continuously feeding sediment into that environment. So there should be the OPSM, this isn't my field here, specifically my field, but the purpose of the OPSM is to give you that information to demonstrate where the difference is, what the contributions of the mining activity discharges are, what that background underlying is throughout that period of time as well.
You're feeding the model with the data and then you're using the model to inform your data and your compliance limits.
Yeah, like, so
don't forget there are going to be times when there's no mining taking place.
Yeah.
So the data to inform the potential changes in compliance limit would only be collected during times where there's no mining taking place?
So there's data being fed into it all the time.
Constant.
I suspect that this will be an area of deliberation by the technical working group to identify a key so the target doesn't keep on changing.
The other thing
I will point out in terms of the EMMP, so it sets the monitoring but it also sets the management framework. So as part of the EMMP, and particularly section 6.5.3.2 of the impact assessment talks around what some of those operational responses might be, where either a 10% change in some of those percentile limits below the 95th percentile are met. So that doesn't require an immediate cessation, but it requires an investigation. If you hit the 95th percentile, that requires an immediate cessation in the mining activities until the cause of those changes can actually be determined, and then there's the certification process with the EPA before the activities can commence. So that environmental management plan, so there's the management plan element of it, and there's also the monitoring plan. So it actually has two roles, and it's a very fundamental document as the mining operation takes off. So that's a document that needs to be independently prepared, needs to be peer-reviewed, needs to be reviewed by the TRG, and then certified by the EPA. There's a role for Mataranga Māori input through there, either through the Kaitiaki reference group or through direct engagement with iwi, depending on how iwi choose to be involved in the project if this consent is granted. So there's a number of roles and mechanisms through which that EMMP plays in the project from an operational sense. The operational sediment plume, we've kind of been talking between this, but as I was saying, it predicts the background, predicts the extraction suspended sediment concentrations, and it's the tool which distinguishes the operation from the background SC. It also forecasts the plume spread, the plume location, and those types of things. So it's the driver for understanding those sort of mining effects associated with the sedimentation of the process. developed within 6 months. Real-time modelling from MetOcean, those sorts of things, those are the types of live inputs to ensure the accuracy is correct, validated and calibrated every 6 months within the PCMP period and then the first 3 years of extraction. So that, Dr. Giles, that might sort of give you a bit of an indication. So yes, it needs to be developed within 6 months. That refinement process during the pre-commencement environmental monitoring period and things will ensure that that model is running as it's intended once the actual extraction activities kick off. So it will be constantly being revisited, calibrated and validated through that process. It's also informed, as I say, by the operational assessment report, which essentially sets out the mine plan for the preceding 12 months. Looking talks about the grade control drilling results, identifies the fine sediment areas, and sets out the sort of the process and schedule and location. So that's the OAR is set out in condition 87 of the document there. In terms of the integration of the two documents, in terms of the PCMP and the operational sediment plan, we've spoken about that, and also spoken about the OAR, which I had a note for there in terms of the role of that. In terms of the post-extraction benthic recovery, the plan itself is set out in condition 57, and that speaks to what's required to be looked at during that benthic recovery process, and then the reporting requirement, which talks about the assessment, the analysis of the results, any recommendations, and how that process must be peer reviewed by the TRG, prepared by an expert, and then certified by the EPA. There's also the role for recommendations and other response mechanisms through that process if the recovery isn't occurring as it's intended. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the pre-commencement environmental monitoring plan is the tool which is used to set the base target environment for the recovery against which that 5% quantitative measure is measured against. The technical review group, so it is, the intent is it's to provide an independent multidisciplinary oversight to the process as a whole. Now, I identify there is one error here, and I am hugely embarrassed how that got in there, but there is a bullet point three, strengthen adaptive management. Now, I just need to be very clear, that should be process management and not adaptive management. And I guess the key... The key issue here for mine.
I won't be buying you a beer.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a faux pas there on my end. I do apologise for that. But I think this isn't a situation where there isn't confidence in the data set and the information that's sitting there in front of us. We do not consider, based on the technical team that supports this process and the assessments they have undertaken, that there is uncertainty in terms of the data. There's fixed limits identified through the consent process and the consent conditions, and the pre-commencement monitoring will be used to build on that existing baseline data, and it will be used to validate and verify those fixed limits, which in turn control effects. There's an operational sediment plume model which will be consistently calibrated and verified throughout the process. Again, as I said, there may be some change to the numerical volume associated with those limits which drive effects, but those limits which drive the effects, in being the percentages, won't change throughout the process. There's an independent process for oversight and review through this process, and there's also hardline limits which, if they are reached, there is a set trigger and a response identified within the condition set. So I just wanted to make that clarification and provide that minor amendment there. One of the key roles through the TRG is the role, the provision for a role if it's used by iwi. And there's also other memberships is made up by the TRC, Fisheries Inshore Group or Sanford, the Kaitiakitanga Reference Group, Te Tai Hauru, fishing forum, DOC, Coupe, plus other specialists. So that technical review group in the condition sets out a requirement of skill sets which must be provided as part of that process. And the key role is sort of reviewing of the management and environmental monitoring plans and any amendments, comparing results against the pre-commencement data, recommending any new monitoring that's required, incorporation of Matsuranga Māori, undertaking meetings and those types of things. So they're a key group that provides for an independent lens through which the actual effects of the application, the activity as it's progressing, are looked at and reviewed with an independent lens. And Mr. Kemble will know that's and others who've sat on RMA process, that a technical review group or the likes is a common tool sort of when there are sort of quite complex technical issues as part of the process. In terms of the cultural conditions that we have set out in the document, conditions 72 to 80, as I spoke to earlier, the TTR acknowledged the opposition from the iwi groups. I spoke briefly on the overlaps between the environmental effects and the physical cultural effects, and you know, in terms of assessment of effects on fisheries, kaimoana species and those types of things, Dr. McDiamond spoke to some of those during her slides. We consider, based on the technical information in front of us and where there are those crossover physical cultural effects, that the condition set provided will ensure that any effects on those elements are appropriately provided for. In terms of the metaphysical effects, as I was saying, the provision for acknowledgement of relationship, the role of the Kaitiaki reference group, and some of those other elements provided for in the Kaitiaki reference group condition will go some way to providing for provision of those metaphysical elements. We expect that through engagement, either through the process itself or through a hui or a cascade of options for engagement, as you explored, Mr. Chair, with Mr. Majuri earlier on, that there may be some further input in terms of the tangata whenua conditions and how they may better provide. But in lieu of specific direction in respect to the conditions, we've developed this set, which we think, as we say, addresses the physical aspects of the cultural effects, but also goes to some extent to provide metaphysical impacts. They are developed as OGA conditions, as we say, due to the lack of the direct input from the iwi groups and those entities. They have the mitigation that's actually spoken to within those conditions is set out within 513.4 of the impact assessment itself as well. And I've just got the intent of those conditions and then talks through the key components. So the key components are the recognition of the relationship, the provision for the opportunity to form a Kaitiaki reference group, the purpose is to embed Kaitiaki tanga into the monitoring, provide for appropriate cultural input liaisons through the process, contributed to by the applicant, but a iwi-led tool. Kaitiaki monitoring program, which again is provided by TTR, but the direction comes from the Kaitiaki reference group, should they be stood up. If the Kaitiaki reference group isn't stood up, there is a requirement for TTR to continue to provide an opportunity and invitation to those parties to be involved in that form through the process on an annual basis. There's also, and I talked to that in the last bullet point there, in terms of every 12 months. This is just a bit of a table showing the difference between the reference group, the role of the reference group, and the Kaitiaki monitoring program. As I said, the Kaitiaki reference group is an iwi forum provided for, funded and facilitated by TTR. The Kaitiaki monitoring program is a requirement regardless of the development of the Kaitiaki reference group. Community fisheries relationships. Again, building trust and transparency with the public through sharing of information, making available regular engagement opportunities, delivering tangible community benefits, which Mr. Eggers talked through with his training facilities and those other job opportunities and things. Provision for an operational support infrastructure to be confirmed. I think there's some discussions that Mr. Eggers alluded to around that process. But these conditions capture the intended outcomes through that process. But as I say, the key thing here is, particularly in respect to the fisheries industry, is that sharing of information and setting out an ability to coordinate activities, ensure that there are no crossover issues or concerns. Mr. Eggers confirmed that a fisheries vessel could come within sort of 300 metres of the mining operation. So it's just letting them know where the intended sort of operations are. And much like the comments around the location and the area that the seabirds work in, you know, these fishing trawlers have quotas which cover a large area. So the ability to work together, you know, through an information sharing activity should you know, reduce any crossover impacts to the extent that it's necessary. There's a whole range of project management plans, which the intent of these is to ensure environmental protection, operational safety, and they'll be developed through the process prior to operational activities occurring. I won't go into too much detail on these. The purpose, the intent, the specifics are set out within each of those consent conditions that capture for each of those elements. But they do cover the mammals, the seabirds, the simultaneous operations plan, the collision contingency management plan, and the biosecurity management plan. And then we go into the reporting requirements. So there's a quarterly report which provides regular operational transparency and compliance tracking. There's annual reports which builds on the quarterly reports but also has an evaluation process on performance and sets out future extraction planning. There's a requirement around sort of change of any a notice to change of operations to those other existing users out in the STB out there, and then there's a review mechanism which gives the EPA the ability to respond to any changes or risks that defer that have resulted from the process that weren't anticipated at the time. There's a bit more detail in terms of what those reporting conditions require in there. And as I say, there's the distinct difference between the quarterly and the annual is the quarterly report is just a results reporting, where the annual report provides for an evaluation and includes a critical review of the data that's extracted. And also that annual report goes to the TRG as part of their role in looking at what the previous 12 months and the future 12 months are actually looking at achieving there. In terms of this next one, this is the last slide here. So the intent of the framework is sort of set out there. It's to ensure that the operations are tightly controlled, transparent, science-led. The conditions provide for a robust monitoring process pre, during, and post. They will be independently reviewed. There's a request from TTR that there's cultural input through that process, and that's provided for through the conditions. The conditions enable a responsive management of operations if unanticipated results occur. It looks to deliver a number of outcomes for the community and iwi alongside environmental safeguards. And it maintains the EPA and stakeholder oversight and engagement across the life of the consents. Basically, the conditions as a package, they provide a comprehensive form and a multi-layered framework, which balancing environmental protection, cultural recognition, community benefits and accountability so that the process can proceed in confidence, transparency. I guess the conditions will allow the operations to be kept within a clear and measurable framework with boundaries, limits and reporting. It incorporates science, Matauranga, Māori, if iwi choose to be involved in the process through the TRG, and the Kaitiaki Reference Group. It protects the existing interests, it provides control zones and acknowledges those other operators out there, and it delivers a full life cycle package for the application itself. That's all. If I'm happy to take any questions if there are specifics. I'm sorry, I have kind of swept through those.
I've only got one. The project management plans, when dealing with marine mammals in particular, mm-hmm. that's one I'm quite is a draft of those?
Yes. So the marine mammal, let me switch back to those. And so they have both been updated since the 2016. Sorry, let me just.
Appendix 5?
Yeah, it is appendix. I can provide you with the exact numbers there.
I was just curious as to whether we've not been drafted rather than just...
Yes, yeah. So the seabirds and the mammals are the two that have been drafted, as well as the baseline environmental monitoring plan and the environmental monitoring plan, which have not been updated since the 2016 application, but the management plans have.
Cool, thank you.
No problem, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schofield. Mr. Schofield.
Thank you.
You're right up there.
Yeah.
Should click on the old system. Lots of questions.
This one here to move on. Beauty. Thank you.
Good afternoon at last. We're getting shorter as we've gone through the day, and I will be the shortest of all the presenters you hear from. No, with the exception of Mr. Majuri, perhaps. Just by way of introduction, my name is Morgan Slyfield. I'm a barrister based in Wellington. I have been practising law for the last 29 years, and I had experience in this marine consenting field when I first was engaged by the EPA on TTR's very first application, 2013. So I was engaged by the EPA to be a special advisor to the DMC who heard that first application. Subsequently, I was engaged by the EPA, re-engaged by the EPA to be an advisor to the DMC who listened to the second application made by Chatham Rock Phosphate. And then when TTR brought its second application in 2016 to the EPA, I had no involvement in that in front of the EPA, but became involved as that then went through the appeals through the High Court, Court of Appeal, Supreme Court. I joined the legal team that was assisting TTR through that process. And so I've been involved through those processes and also then the reconsideration process that was ultimately withdrawn in 2024, and am the lead author of the legal components that are in the impact assessment. So that section 8 of the impact assessment that deals with the statutory framework is predominantly my work, although it has been reviewed by the other members of the legal team and had input, of course, from the relevant experts. Before I move on to what's on my slides, I did want to just check that I understood, Dr. Giles, the request you made a short while ago about getting some different naming on the update information. And because as I understood it, you were describing this difficulty matching it. Yes.
It's this on the website.
Yes.
The list of documents that form part of the application. The naming of these links to the PDFs is very different to the way these documents
I think I understand.
Are referred to in your assessment.
It talks about evidence of Dr. Childerhouse work where we can identify the specific report that it's linked to in terms of the
report, for example,
yes.
Here is called NIWA Nearshore Modelling or Nearshore Wave Modelling,
yes.
But then in documents it will be referred,
it's actually
referred
no,
for
it's
as
actually,
name, date.
Yeah. It actually refers to the author names.
So this seems to be more descriptive names that don't match the title of the document.
As the author of the memorandum, can I tell you that the names we used are the names from the website. So I think what's confusing about it is you have to go, you have to scroll on the website down to the point where it's dealing with the 2023 and 2024 evidence that was submitted as part of the application.
So, but then we only have the actual evidence, not the technical reports.
Correct.
For example, I can't find McDonald and Hatfield
in this list,
or McDermott et al. 2024 in this list.
Gotcha.
So that would be...
Those, yes, fine.
That would be
understood.
Very, very helpful.
Yes.
Otherwise you find all four of us doing the same.
Difficult. Okay. So as you will be well aware, you're dealing with a new piece of legislation, and that is the Fast Track Approvals Act. And as I've put it, that establishes a new hierarchy for decision making, where at the top of the hierarchy sits the purpose of the Act, which, as you know, is to facilitate the delivery of infrastructure and development projects with significant regional or national benefits. And I say there, this must be given the greatest weight. That is, of course, taken from the decision-making criteria that are set out in the Act, and those are in two places. They're in Section 81 of the Act, and for this consent, they're in Clause 6 of Schedule 10. That's where the direction to give the greatest weight to the purpose of the FTA Act sits. As I say on the second point on the slide, all other matters are then subordinate, i.e. they are to be taken into account. And I've listed there some of the other matters to be taken into account. I want to be very clear, that is not an exhaustive list by any stretch of the imagination. But it identifies what I suspect will become some of the very core matters for your consideration, which include the purpose of the EEZ Act, that's the protection of the environment from material harm, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The decision-making criteria under the EEZ Act, which are in sections 59 and 60 of the EEZ Act, and the requirement under what are called the information principles in the EEZ Act to favour caution and environmental protection. As I've said, in the exercise of taking account of all relevant matters, the purpose of the FTA Act is required to be given the greatest weight. And perhaps a useful observation to make at the start is I've used the word subordinate there, but I want to be very clear that I'm not suggesting that in any way any of the matters that I've listed there or other matters that are to be taken into account are to be in any respect disregarded. That is not the legal requirement. All the matters that are in the list must be given due consideration, but inescapably, take account of is a lesser standard than the standard that you're probably all familiar with at some level in other legislation like the RMA, where there are matters to be recognised and provided for or given effect to or not be inconsistent with. Those are all higher standards than take into account.
So Morgan, just on that, so taken into account is obviously very similar to Section 8 of the Resource Management Act.
Yes.
Can we apply that it's got this, some jurisprudence around what that means relative to the other aspects?
Yes.
Of that? Can we utilise that jurisprudence in this construct, or do we have to look for some other meaning of what taken into account means in the Fast Track legislation?
No, I think you can use that jurisprudence. There has helpfully been some other guidance that I'm going to point you towards as well, where I think you can get a little bit more clarity around how to apply this hierarchy. I will say as well that the requirement to take into account here, because it has the purpose of the FTA slotted in on top of it, and ultimately we'll come on to talk about what that means in terms of the proportionality test that operates at the, you know, decline grant level, it somewhat influences then how you apply the matters that need to be taken into account. I think a useful one of the cases that might be useful just to make you aware of is the decision that came after, my friend Mr. Majuri referred you to Justice Gendel's decision quite recent in the Ngāti Kukuhapu Trust matter, which is the Port of Tauranga litigation. There's been an even more recent decision came out on the 27th of August, and that's a decision of Justice Bolts, for which the citation is 2025 NZHC 2453. And although that was dealing with a different situation, it's not an EE, that was another fast-track application, not an EEZ application, but an RMA style application. There's a very useful pronouncement made by Justice Bolt at paragraph 65, where he's reflecting on the relationship between the fast track overlay and the RMA provisions that sit underneath, where he says FTA applications must include an assessment of the activity against sections 5, 6, and 7 of the RMA, but decision makers are not directed to recognise and provide for section 6 matters, nor are they required to have particular regard to the factors listed in section 7. These are all RMA references, and they are not required to consider the principles of the treaty. That's a reference to section 8 of the RMA. And goes on to say at 66, in enacting the FTA framework, Parliament made a deliberate decision to de-emphasise factors which might militate against approval. For example, the Cabinet Minute, which approved the inclusion of the 149 listed projects, noted it was the government's intention to establish a consenting and permitting process that makes it substantially easier for projects to be approved than the status quo, with a high bar needing to be reached for a panel to decline a project. Now, that's not a pronouncement about an EEZ application, but in my submission, it outlines a relationship between the FTA and the various types of approvals that sit underneath it, and provides a helpful commentary on how that relationship is intended to work. The second...
There's no references there in that judgment to any kind of presumption arising from the fact that an application gets through the gate to this stage of consideration. No one's gone that far yet.
I've heard
some general discussion about there being that sort of presumption, but there's nothing in the judgment that...
No, there isn't. I agree with that. The other case I was going to draw to your attention was one that was referred to in the application. The decision recently came out on the Bledisloe Wharf fast track application, and that decision has referred to the Court of Appeals guidance in the Enterprise Miramar decision, which was a decision concerning the housing and special accords, housing areas legislation. And the reason that was being referred to is because that was another example of an environmental statute which had a number of assessment criteria prescribed, and it allocated within the explicit wording of the statute a hierarchy or weighting that needed to be applied to those assessment criteria. So in that case, there were five assessment criteria under the relevant provision, which is section 34 of that legislation, which has since been repealed. And it said you needed to give effect to those criteria greater to lesser. So the first was the most important and the fifth the least important. And I commend to you the description that you can find in the Bledisloe Wharf fast track panel decision that attempts to take those principles described in the Enterprise Miramar decision and apply them in a Fast Track Act scenario. I won't take you through those, but they do quite a useful job, I think you'll find, at translating those across to a fast track situation. A if I can move from there to the second noteworthy feature that differentiates this process from all of the prior processes that TTR has gone through with the EPA or the various appeal courts, and that is there are no environmental bottom lines here. And I draw attention to this because it was a key finding by the Supreme Court in 2021.
September 20.
Yep. That TTR's previous application had exceeded some bottom lines, or at least the EPA's decision hadn't addressed some matters that the Supreme Court identified as bottom lines, and there were three in particular, which were protecting the environment from material harm, which is from the purpose provision in Section 10.1b of the EEZ Act, the requirement to favour caution and environmental protection from Section 61.2 of that Act, and also then borrowing from the NZCPS, avoiding adverse effects on natural character or outstanding natural features. This is maybe a useful point to come back to the question that was asked about the application of the NZCPS. The short answer is no, it doesn't apply in the EEZ. But what the Supreme Court found is that because there was a reference in Section 59 to other marine management regimes, and the way that's defined is broad enough to capture the NZCPS, and because the NZCPS avoidance policies had what they described as a synergy or a lockstep with Section 10.1b, the avoidance of material harm provision in the EEZ Act, they said that did then apply. The reason I say there are no environmental bottom lines here are really twofold. On the one hand, you have the fact that all of these provisions, to the extent that they are triggered as matters that are to be taken into account, not applied in an absolute form. So that's the first part. The second part is when you go to Section 85, which prescribes the very limited grounds on which a consent could be declined, it doesn't provide for any of these matters to be a basis for declining consent. And of course, an environmental bottom line by nature has to operate as an on-off switch. They can't operate as that way because Section 85 prescribes the very limited number of grounds for which an application could be declined. Now, I did want to come back to the material harm test because I'm anticipating it's going to be a crucial part of your deliberations in due course. The Supreme Court was interpreting Section 10.1b, which doesn't use that term material harm. It talks about protecting the environment from pollution, which the Supreme Court held didn't mean protecting it from all harm but only material harm, and that material harm had a very specific meaning which is prescribed in some detail in the Supreme Court's decision. The key things being it takes account of conditions and the extent to which conditions might avoid, remedy or mitigate harm so that it is reduced to the level where it is not material. And the other part is that the Supreme Court identified that there are many dimensions to be assessed when considering what the harm of an activity is. They listed, in the case of TTR's application, that this needed to include the flora, fauna, natural characteristics of the area affected, which they described as a qualitative dimension, needed to include the volume of the sediment discharged, which they described as a quantitative dimension, the time for which the effect will last, they describe that as a temporal dimension, and the size of the area affected, i.e. a spatial dimension in their terms. So they were very clear that it's a multi-dimensional analysis to consider what is or is not material harm that has qualitative, quantitative, spatial and temporal characteristics, all of which have to be accounted for. And the other point to note is it's about protecting the environment from material harm, and the environment under the Fast Track Act is not the environment that exists for the purposes of resource management. For example, it does not include anything other than natural resources. So in a Resource Management Act setting, we're dealing with natural and physical resources, which brings into play all of this stuff that we're surrounded by, not just the natural environment, but the Fast Track Approval Act is only concerned with protecting the natural environment.
Does that rule out metaphysical issues? Is that, are you taking it to that extent?
It doesn't, because they can still, a cultural interest of that sort can still find its way into the analysis through the relevant part of Section 59 of the EEZ Act.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Then that brings me on to the limited grounds for declining approval. The core ground is this test, the proportionality test that sits within Section 85, which is whether the adverse impacts are sufficiently significant to be out of proportion to the project's regional or national benefits. The key things to note about this test are those I've set out on the slide. It takes into account conditions for managing adverse impacts, and that's expressly stated in the section. It is not a no effects standard. If the benefits are significant, then a significant adverse impact might not be out of proportion to those benefits. Third point, it's not an exact measure, but a relative measure. Things do not need to be equal to be in proportion. And fourthly, and again, the section is explicit about this, cannot be based, the proportionality assessment cannot be based on inconsistency with another act or marine management regime. So, for example, if the NZCPS did apply and you formed a view that a grant of approval was inconsistent with policy 13 of the NZCPS, that would not be, on the direction provided by the statute, that could not be a basis for finding that it's sufficiently significant to be out of proportion. So it does require you to put aside quite a lot of potential areas for consideration, although I will emphasise that TTR's position on this is that the adverse impacts don't get to the scale that really makes this a difficult test for you to apply. Of course, that's a matter for you to assess on the evidence, on the merits, but I highlight that that's the that's the direction of travel from TTR's perspective. I should add here, I've only talked about the proportionality test. There are, of course, other potential grounds. I've outlined in the impact assessment that whether you have adequate information across the board is arguably another ground for declining an approval. Not here, according to TTR, but it's a potential ground. And a breach of Section 7, namely the section that Mr. Majuri took you to that refers to the treaty settlements and the like, could also be a potential ground, but there is some complexity around that. And the complexity is, as you may have picked up, Section 7.2 says that Section 7.1 doesn't apply to anyone exercising a judicial function. And then you go through to Sections 82 and 85 of the Fast Track Approvals Act, and it looks on the face of those provisions that you are required to apply Section 7, and it is a potential ground for declining under Section 85. So there is some apparent ambiguity between a direction in Section 7 sub 2 that says in a judicial function you don't apply Section 7, and then Section 85, which seems to be saying, actually, if you're operating this off switch in Section 85, you have to consider whether it would breach Section 7. That was another matter that helpfully was identified by that fast-track panel dealing with the Bledisloe Wharf application. They recorded the existence of the ambiguity and proceeded on the basis that they did need to apply Section 7, but in order to cover themselves jurisdictionally, they said, in case we're wrong about that, we will also say what our decision would be if we weren't required to consider Section 7. Either way, they granted the relevant approvals.
Did they assume that panels under the Act are performing a judicial function?
Yes, they made a statement to that effect, yes. So I want to leave you with some ideas about what might then look like core legal issues that you will need to work your way through as you consider TTR's application. This is not an attempt to be exhaustive. Again, there might be a lot of other legal issues that are in play, particularly from the perspective of other parties or commenters. But it is my attempt to say, well, I think these are probably where the key contests might end up lying. Firstly, whether you have the best available information, and that's both in terms of what the existing environment is that is in the South Taranaki Bight, and also what the impacts of the project might be. And that's a requirement that comes from Section 61(1)(b) of the EEZ Act. Second one, will there be material harm to the environment, which is the test that is derived from Section 10(1)(b) of the EEZ Act that we've just talked about. Thirdly, will there be an adverse impact on existing interests? That comes from Section 59(2) of the EEZ Act. Fourthly, will granting consent with conditions and management plans adequately favour caution and environmental protection? Now, that's one of the information principles in the EEZ Act, and I should say there, the requirement to favour caution and environmental protection is only triggered if there is what the EEZ Act describes as uncertainty or inadequacy in the information that you have. TTR does not consider there is any inadequacy in the information that you have, but will be acknowledging that inherent in this environment, there is a degree of uncertainty. And an example of that is, as you've heard, some amount of the effects assessment here is reliant on a modelling process, which is inherently has a component of uncertainty to it. All modelling is wrong, but some is useful. So acknowledging that there is that uncertainty component, TTR responsibly says, well, this part of the information principles is triggered. Will granting consent adequately favour caution and environmental protection? What's different about the way this is triggered here from previous situations where that's been triggered on TTR's prior applications is that can't operate as an on-off switch for the application. But it is going to be, I think, a key matter for your assessment. Obviously, I think, how significant the regional and national benefits are will be a key matter for your assessment, because that will be the thing that sits on the other side of the scales, if I can put it that way, when it comes to any proportionality test that you end up applying in accordance with Section 85. Would granting approval breach Section 7? I'm putting that on the list because it's clear that there is strong opposition from a number of iwi to TTR's application, and so I'm anticipating that there will be some contest about whether Section 7 applies, and if so, what Section 7 means. So I'm putting that on the list, not because TTR would say this is going to be a linchpin, but because it's anticipating that there will be debate around that issue. And then finally, of course, taking into account all the proposed conditions of consent, will the adverse impact of the project be out of proportion to its regional and national benefits? And I don't think I need to say anything more on that front at this stage. That is all I was intending to do in terms of an overview of the legal situation, but I'm very happy to take any questions on any aspect of that if you have any.
Yeah, I don't. Can I just I just ask you the question I asked Mr. Majuri, and that is would you suggest to the panel that a discrete hearing on these issues, these legal issues, would be a helpful way of resolving some of these arguments? For example, the question of the application of Section 7.
It could be. I do think it's going to depend to a high degree on what further information you receive from commenters. So, depending on what that information looks like, it could certainly be one way of trying to most efficiently deal with a contest in that space.
I mean, it wouldn't be a lengthy hearing.
No, well, there could be a very focused, identification of what the issue is, who the parties are, who the stakeholders are who are raising that issue, and then as you raised, sir, a pre-submission of submissions on the matter, then a hearing could be very efficient.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, that's all been very helpful. Mr. Eggers, can we just address you on the sameness of the proposal, please? In your letter to the panel on the 22nd of August, you suggest a full-day site visit going by a vessel from Whanganui Port out to the site and so on. And you've suggested there that the visit would give the panel a greater sense of the project's purpose, how you intend to recover and ship the VTM concentrates, and give us an opportunity to view the seafloor within the proposed area of operations, and it might give us a chance to also see the magnetic recovery equipment on board.
Great.
I'm just wondering whether actually going out to sea like that would give us any better understanding of the nature of the project and what's planned than we can get from the large volume of material that's been provided and from whatever else we might receive from the commenters. And whether, certainly going out there would be additional information, but whether what's involved in doing that would really add significantly to the panel's understanding, and in particular to the criteria on which we have to make our decision.
I understand where you're coming from here, and thank you for that. I think when I say it puts it in perspective and context, there's been a lot of commentary and questions around the effects and where we will see those effects, how we will measure them, etc. And today, in a way, we took you out there and we showed you the seabed, and we can look at that for as long as you like, and it saves you a day trip. I agree with that. It's a long way out. It's 4 hours out in the vessel, two or three hours out there, perhaps, and 4 hours back, so it's quite a big day. But when you're out there, you'll appreciate how remote we are and what we're doing, and how it's nearly farcical to think what we're doing out there, and we'll show you what we're doing out the best we can, how that's going to affect a surf break along the coast and surfing and the surf clubs are against it, suppose. How will it affect Kaimoala gathering along that coastline? And it's one thing to read a report about it and look at it, look at a diagram and a plan. It's another thing to go to these places and have a look. There's not much to see there. I'm the first to admit that. There's very little to see there. And I actually wondered who you might want to go with you if you choose to go, who you would want on that trip. And I had to have a laugh because I asked Alison whether or not she would like to go out there. And she laughed and said, no, thanks. I've been out there many times. That's not why I was asking. I thought you might have questions of the marine scientists out there. And you know.
That raises what I think is a fundamental difficulty with the proposal. Not that we're ungrateful, I want you to understand that we really appreciate the offer. But if we did go out there, what we learn would be evidence. So what we see, what we're told while we're out there, is evidence.
Yes.
Related to the application. And to be fair to the other participants, they would also need to share in that evidence, to benefit from that evidence. It just seems to me that there are some serious practical difficulties in the panel going out there with a few experts, possibly, or other people, and leaving behind, and you have seen the list of likely commenters. Hundreds.
Well, a couple of things about that. That's true. This was recommended in minute from the panel convener. Might well take a site visit, so we address that. That's part.
Well, I'm not suggesting it was wrong to make the proposal. Yeah. I'm thinking of the practical implications.
There isn't any evidence that various other submitters aren't available of within our application, as you will, it'll confirm what we're saying, I guess.
I think the convener's minute suggested our site visit a land-based component.
Yeah.
It's not quite how I read it, but
whether she had a voyage out to sea in mind or not, I'm just thinking about the practical implications of this. It wouldn't be consistent with the principles of natural justice for us to be out on the vessel learning things about the proposed operation without that being information also being available to the other participants. So for example, if we take the context into a civil case in the High Court, there's an argument over a boundary and commonly in those situations, or the height of some trees overlooking, preventing a view or overshadowing the property. And a judge might go out, have a view of the location, but the other parties to the proceeding necessarily would be there, their counsel would be there. Because what is taking place in those circumstances is effectively the giving of evidence to the decision maker.
Right.
So from a practical point of view, we would have to offer the same opportunity to everyone who's commented. That's what I see as being one of the fundamental problems with the proposal.
A number of them say they have been out there.
Yes.
Not good area,
no, I realise that. I'm talking about process here though, Mr. Eggers. I know you're taking a practical view. I have to take a much more...
And we're entirely in your hands on this, of course. It's up to the panel to decide whether or not you wish to take a site visit.
Yeah.
We've offered it. We're given the rationale for it. I think it's entirely...
We appreciate the offer. And we haven't decided yet what we'll do about it. But I just wanted to raise these issues with you so that
I appreciate that.
Have a discussion about them.
Yep.
Mr. Slyfield, do you have a view about that?
a view driven by my experience, my RMA experience, which is it's very commonplace for decision makers in an RMA setting to undertake a site visit, and the way they tend to deal with that is, in some respects, far less formal than a High Court judge on a civil dispute would, and that's bearing in mind that the Environment Court is not bound by the rules of evidence that's explicit in the RMA.
So,
yes. So, it wouldn't be uncommon if this were an RMA hearing, and if you thought that was going to be useful for you to do it, I think. Whether it is going to be useful is obviously your call to make. And I think there would have to be some restriction around who was accompanying you and to what extent you were going to rely on anything that they might, you know, you might need to seek direction about, are we there yet? Yes, you're entering the mining area, or that type of thing.
Yes, but then if we're just going to go out there to have a look, and no one telling us anything about what we're doing, there's not much point. I'm not suggesting that a site visit's a bad idea,
no.
But it's the method that we'd adopt in this particular case, in almost unique circumstances, where it seems to me the practical difficulties of being fair to all participants render it somewhat impractical. That's all I'm saying.
And I'm hearing that, sir.
Yeah.
I don't think I can add any.
No. Well, I'm grateful to you. As I say, we are not ungrateful for the offer, but we'll need to take into account the practical implications of it, and weigh those against what benefits there might be.
I was going to ask. I think it's very important, and we'd seek your guidance on who would you want on that vessel with you. You might not want me, for argument.
Well, we would let you know. We would let you know.
Yeah.
We would put conditions around the visit, and let you know who should attend and for what purpose and so on.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Do you have any other questions or points you'd like to make?
No.
I'm good. Thank you. Well, can I just conclude then by thanking you, all of you, for the presentation. We've remarked during adjournments how helpful this has been to our understanding of the application and where we find the information, and to get a better feel for what you have in mind with the project. So we are very grateful to you for the effort that's obviously put in a considerable amount of work into doing this, and we appreciate that very much. As I've said, the transcript of of today's presentation will be on the website for everyone who has not been able to attend to read, and we may endeavour to undertake a similar exercise once we've got the comments in and want to hear from those who have things to say about your application. But thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for taking the time and giving us the opportunity.
Right.